This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Newslink.
Hello, welcome to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the program, we'll hear why the Spanish Prime Minister's dissolution of Parliament and call for new elections amounts to something like a surrender. We'll hear the Pope's surprising take on the future of the Catholic Church in Germany as he wraps up his visit here.
The Catholic Church in Germany would become less rich, it would become a poorer church, and it would become less and less influential and powerful in society. And he said that was a good thing.
And we'll find out more about Cold War-era sports doping. A new set of evidence, I promise. All of those stories and much more coming up on Newslink. On Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. Let's get started. Spain's Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero dissolved the country's parliament on Monday and officially set November 20th as the date for an early general election, which opinion polls predict his ruling socialists will lose by a wide margin. In a virtual admission of his unpopularity with voters at present, Zapatero will not be standing for re-election, Guy Hedgeco reports.
Su Majestad el Rey acaba de rubricar el Real Decreto de Convocatoria de Elecciones Generales.
Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero announces the end of the current legislative cycle and the start of the run-up to the November 20th general elections. Zapatero met with King Juan Carlos earlier on Monday to rubber-stamp the official calling of elections. Zapatero himself is not running for a third term. Instead, his former minister Alfredo Pérez Rubalcaba will be the socialist candidate. But the candidacy is seen by many as a poisoned chalice. The socialists are lagging behind the opposition Popular Party, according to polls, which give the conservatives a double-digit lead. Rubalcaba's rival in the election is Mariano Rajoy, who made clear he will put the economy firmly at the centre of the campaign now beginning.
La tarea que tenemos por delante no será una tarea fácil. Pero yo les digo que en el Partido Popular estamos ilusionados.
We don't have an easy task ahead of us, he said, but we in the Popular Party are excited and ready. For me as a candidate for Prime Minister, the most exciting challenge is to get Spain out of its economic crisis. We Spaniards have always faced up to difficulties, and we have always overcome them. The difficulties currently facing Spain include Europe's highest unemployment rate at 21%, flat growth, and a large deficit. These problems have left the country exposed to damaging market turbulence in recent months. Zapatero has spent the last year trying to fend off such speculation and talk of a possible EU bailout by implementing an unpopular reform programme. These reforms, such as freezing pensions, cutting civil service salaries, and introducing a constitutional change that limits the deficit, have alienated left-leaning Spaniards and will have a major impact on the outcome of the November vote, says political analyst Víctor Sampedro. The most likely result is a convincing win for the Popular Party over the Socialists. The Socialists have lost the support of many of their traditional voters, he said. Zapatero, whose own approval rating is at a record low, said he will not be campaigning for his party and instead will continue to govern as normal over the coming weeks. His successor as Prime Minister is expected to take office in December. Guy Hedgeco, Deutsche Welle Radio, Madrid.
Across Europe, in Russia, they're also gearing up for an election, of sorts. Vladimir Putin looks set to rule Russia for another 6 years. His party, United Russia, approved his candidacy for the presidency at a convention in Moscow on Saturday. In effect, he'll just be swapping jobs with current President Dmitry Medvedev, who will take over from him as prime minister after the elections. Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin was apparently a bit miffed that he'd been left out of the backroom deal, which is being presented as a fait accompli, and so he resigned. Now, regime critics fear that Russia is heading for a long period of stagnation, reminiscent of Soviet times. Kher Korkop reports.
The standing ovations for Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev at the United Russia Party Congress sounded like a collective sigh of relief. The decision by the current Russian Prime Minister and President to swap chairs put an end to months of speculation over whether or not Putin would have another go at the presidency in the elections next March. At the start of the Congress, even the party leadership didn't have a clue as to what the two Russian leaders had decided about their future roles. But as Vladimir Putin explained, the scenario unfolded exactly as they had planned long before. I know, he said, that not only the members of United Russia, but all our supporters expect from the President of the Russian Federation and from the Prime Minister proposals about the structure of power after the elections. I want to inform you that we already several years ago agreed on what we would do in the future. Medvedev added that they had agreed on this even before the current tandem, with Medvedev as president and Putin as his powerful prime minister, was realized 4 years ago. Since the constitution prohibits a third consecutive term as president, Putin had to step down, and his longtime close aide Medvedev was put forward as a presidential candidate, with Putin in second position. Since then, under Medvedev, the presidential term has been prolonged from 4 to 6 years, which means that Putin, if elected in March, would rule until 2018 and then could win a second term until 2024. Away from the United Russia Congress, news about Putin's likely return received a mixed response. There was laughter at the Congress of the opposition People's Freedom Party, led by former Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov, which has been prohibited from taking part in the parliamentary elections in December. Co-chairman Vladimir Ryzhkov even called it good news for the opposition. For us, for our party, he said, this makes the situation easier, because millions of people who still cherish illusions about President Medvedev and his empty liberal rhetoric will now join our camp. Elsewhere there was disappointment and even anger, with commentators drawing comparisons with the era of Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev, who remained in power for 18 years in what has become known as the period of stagnation. One independent newspaper featured a cartoon on its front page on Monday showing Putin and his inner circle in 2024, depicted in the style of the former Soviet Politburo. At any rate, stagnation is once again becoming a popular word. With Putin back at the helm, economic and political reforms appear unlikely. The sudden departure of Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin, who had served for the past 11 years, is a clear sign of the possible problems ahead. On the eve, Kudrin criticized the government's plans to increase defense spending and pensions. This, he said, will seriously hamper attempts to balance the budget, and the Russian economy will continue to be very much dependent on high oil prices. Gerhard Kuhrkamp, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
Here in Germany, there's no general election on the immediate horizon, but German Chancellor Angela Merkel's coalition has been taking hit after hit in state elections in recent months. Now she's taking her message to the people, going on television to once again warn against letting Greece default on its debts. She said it would destroy investor confidence in the Eurozone and urge the German parliament to approve a new and larger rescue fund in a vote on Thursday. A number of her coalition colleagues, mindful of the beating that they've taken as of late, are against that measure. But with pressure mounting from the likes of the U.S. and China for the Eurozone to act decisively, how much choice do they really have? Gabriel Borod with more.
Chancellor Merkel's appearance on a nationally televised show on Sunday night was a clear sign of just how seriously she's taking the currency crisis. It's a talk show normally reserved for several guests, but Merkel appeared alone to field questions from the host on how to deal with the euro. Her answers were clear-cut and showed visions of a future Europe of monetary and fiscal union.
We have to work to reform the current situation so that Europe can observe member states' budget policies. If guidelines aren't met, if debts get too high, a European court must be able to punish offending states. We cannot continue with our monetary union if there's no way to force member states to follow the rules.
Merkel's message comes at the start of a critical week for the Eurozone. On the one hand, the European Union and the International Monetary Fund are in the middle of a financial audit of Greece to see if the country can avoid bankruptcy in the short term. Perhaps more importantly, on Thursday, the German parliament is set to vote on augmenting the Euro Rescue Fund from 123 to 211 billion euros. But open questions as to whether the fund should be increased abound among parliamentarians, like Carsten Schneider, the Social Democrats' budget speaker.
First of all, will this amount be enough? What if Greece needs more guarantees? Or what about Italy? And what will happen on the markets if we don't approve the package and let Greece go bankrupt?
But can the Bundestag really reject the increases to the rescue fund? This question was turned to Jens Weidmann, the head of Germany's central bank, in a recent budget committee meeting.
Nobody can paint a credible scenario as to what will happen if we allow Greece to go bankrupt. I can assure you, however, that not only Greece would face the difficulty of this scenario.
Despite Weidmann's opposition to a Greek bailout, he's not completely in favor of increasing the Euro Rescue Fund. His main qualm is that it will create a shared liability in Europe that will ultimately diminish fiscal discipline.
How can we create credible rules for this new package? That's the question. We have to work against the current system, which allows offenders who fail to meet the guidelines to be rescued.
Economic facts versus politics. These are the poles between which the Bundestag currently finds itself. Will Parliament follow Merkel's government, increase the fund, and achieve the political will? Or will it apply the brakes, recognition that Germany's economic potential is ultimately limited? It is completely possible for the Bundestag to vote against increasing the rescue fund. The Bundestag now has the final say when it comes to rescue packages funded by taxpayers. But many economists are questioning how fast the rescue facility can work under such conditions. The fund's managing director, Klaus Regling, for one, has his doubts.
You've got 2 days at the most when government bonds have to be sold on stock markets. This must not be forgotten. Such facility must be able to act very fast.
The Bundestag is not only voting on whether to increase its contribution to the rescue fund, it's also looking to set guidelines for how much influence it can wield. For instance, the Bundestag wants to be involved in any future decision affecting which Eurozone members can receive bailout money. If this doesn't get through Parliament, then Germany's representative at the fund will also vote no. But many economists are averse to the idea that Parliament can wield so much influence. Rudolf Hickel of the University of Bremen says these decisions should not be made by non-experts.
Unfortunately, parliamentarians must work without the help of blueprints and make these decisions only with a limited understanding of the issues. We can only attempt to inform them as best we can.
Thursday's vote will be watched by the global financial markets, as it is a sign of whether Europe wants to keep the euro currency. But it will also be watched within Germany, to see how much power the Bundestag will have in European financial affairs in the years to come. Gabriel Borud, Deutsche Welle Radio.
News and information from the heart of Europe. Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster.
Pope Benedict XVI has returned to Rome after a 4-day visit to his native Germany, a trip which saw him crisscross the country to address political leaders and Catholic and Protestant bishops, as well as hold Mass with ordinary Catholics. Benedict did not have much contact with the thousands who took to the streets to protest his visit, and in that he ended his visit still a darling of his previous supporters and a villain to his detractors, I asked Deutsche Welle's religious affairs correspondent, John Barrick, what was the real takeaway from this visit?
Well, the main takeaway for me was in the final speech that he gave in Freiburg on the last day of his visit in the afternoon to 1,500 invited guests representing German Catholic society. I'm now calling this the Freiburg speech because I think this is actually quite explosive in its content. I think it's going to take a few days before the really quite revolutionary content of this speech sinks in, even in Catholic circles. He talked about what was really needed, what he called Entweltlichung. This is a German word that's terribly difficult to translate, but approximately it means, in a theological sense, it means renouncing worldly power and wealth. That was an extraordinary thing for a Pope to talk about. I mean, it sounded like, I thought for a moment, we had St. Francis of Assisi there. He mentioned, used this word no less than six times in a 20-minute speech. And he said, went on to then to say that secularization, the process in which, for example, in the early 19th century, the property and a great deal of the wealth had been taken away from the church and its power diminished, was a huge blessing. He praised secularization, suggested that it would continue in the future. The Catholic Church in Germany would become less rich, it would become a poorer church, and it would become less and less influential and powerful in society. And he said that was a good thing, because he said that the institution has been too important up until now to people. It has stood in the way of the message of love that the church, in fact, should be bearing witness to. Now, that is an extraordinary message, and I think it's going to give people a great deal to think about, particularly in Germany, where you have to bear in mind German bishops are paid by the state, where the state here in Germany collects taxes on behalf of the church, and where the church, despite the official separation of church and state, the Catholic Church has huge political influence.
So should we really take this as a very direct critique of the way that the German Catholic Church relates to government, relates to society?
Well, I think one can. In fact, although the Pope got a standing ovation at the end of this speech, the Catholic bishops and cardinals, I think some of them, are going to need a few days for the implications of it to sink in. And it's quite interesting, in the media in Germany, I bought the newspapers this morning, a broad cross-section of them, there are only two that really picked up on this. There was Germany's most popular tabloid, the Bild Zeitung, which said, does this mean that the German taxpayers in future are not going to pay church tax? And the Frankfurter Allgemeine, which is a very serious broadsheet in Germany, which also tackled the question of briefly in its commentary of relations between the church and the state. But most of the newspapers, even most journalists, don't seem to have actually realized the full implications of this yet.
Deutsche Welle religious affairs correspondent John Barrick there. A bit on religion and society at the grassroots level now. Public schools in Germany have so far had a somewhat haphazard but largely practical approach to accommodating Muslim students who want to observe prayers. On Wednesday, though, the Federal Administrative Court in Leipzig is set to rule on whether German schools have to provide them with an official place to pray. More now from Nicole Goebel.
Yunus was 14 years old when the local school stopped him from observing midday prayers in the corridor. He's gone to court over the issue, and his case marks the first time German courts have had to rule on Muslim prayers in German schools, despite the fact that Muslims have been praying in schools here for decades. Ayman Maziek from the Central Council of Muslims in Germany says the case has been politicized.
I think the case has been hyped from both sides. Now we have almost reached the final legal stage, and that's why it's now turned into a political debate. In the past, schools have been more pragmatic and laid back about the issue, but now that has been pushed back.
Sabine Damir-Geilsdorf agrees. She's an Islam specialist at Bonn University and says that schools usually have a flexible approach to Muslim prayers, so that midday and afternoon prayers can be combined, for example.
The majority of Muslim legal experts agree that it's possible to shorten or combine prayers because of illness, travel, or requirements at work.
Employers, too, have adopted a practical approach to Muslim prayers since the 1960s. Depending on the company, Muslims are allowed to observe prayers if it doesn't interfere with their work. German law stipulates that the state has to be neutral. That means it cannot favour any religious faith or creed, as that would compromise the right to freedom of religion. So German schools have to accommodate both the state's neutrality and the individual's religious freedom, which is something Muslim associations are trying to exploit, says Ralf Gadban from the Protestant University in Berlin.
Es geht um die Schule, um den Staat.
It's about the school, about the state, and its duty to remain neutral. That's where Muslim organizations step in. In this case, it's a convert, and they're often particularly extreme. They try to capitalize on that, Islamize that area, so to speak.
But the fact is that only a small minority belongs to the Muslim organizations, and Ayman Maziek from the Muslim Council rejects such accusations.
It's not down to us. It's down to those often harsh critics of Islam that issues to do with religious practice are artificially whipped up into problems. Our constitution is like a pillar of religious freedom, and if a pupil wants to observe midday prayers in school, it can be done without much fuss.
So to guarantee the right to religious freedom and the neutrality of the state, experts believe it's important to treat everybody the same. So in this case, everybody should have the right to pray. Nicole Gubel, Deutsche Welle Radio.
When the files were opened after the collapse of communism in East Germany just over 20 years ago, evidence was found that the country had systematically doped athletes taking part in international competitions, the Olympics included. It was assumed by some people that doping was essentially an East German problem, a communist problem, and that West German athletes and functionaries had rarely stooped to such practices. The truth, however, was somewhat different, at least according to new research just carried out by two universities. Hardy Grapner reports.
Researchers from Münster University and Humboldt University in Berlin are now claiming there was a state-sponsored system of doping in sports in West Germany as well as in East Germany. There was little evidence of it in the 1950s and 60s, but by the time Communist East Germany attended the Olympic Games in 1972 in Munich, West German sports officials, athletes, physicians and politicians were all very much aware of the practice of doping. After analysing archives and talking to eyewitnesses, the historians found that doping in the West, particularly the use of performance-enhancing anabolic drugs, was not only tolerated, it was actually encouraged by sponsorship, though obviously not under the name of doping. And while East German officials couldn't care less about the impact on the health of their top athletes, the situation in West Germany apparently wasn't very different, the sole exception being that women and minors were more often than not excluded from doping schemes. Giselher Spitzer leads the team of researchers from Humboldt University in Berlin. We've tried to show in our study how much scientific knowledge was available at the time about the harmful side effects of anabolic drugs and other performance-enhancing drugs, he said, and we came to the conclusion that much more was known than previously believed. Through our interviews with physicians and sportsmen who were around at the time, it has been easy to prove that many people's health was seriously damaged through those doping practices. Spitzer does not detect any big differences between doping practices in East and West Germany, but his research fellow from Münster, Michael Krüger, disagrees with him on this point. At Münster University, we are rather reluctant to refer to nationwide and systematic doping in West Germany, he said. The political context was different. In West Germany, there was never a state decree forcing physicians and athletes to dope, but there certainly was a climate of competition between East and West that led to doping in West Germany, at least in some sports. There were also many anti-doping campaigns in West Germany when the situation seemed to get out of hand, but legal provisions to combat it were never properly implemented. The historian's study contains some awkward truths for present-day sports bodies in reunited Germany. Small wonder that Gudrun Doll-Tepper from the German Olympic Sports Federation suspects that it could be some time before the whole report enters the public domain. From my own board members, I know that there are a couple of questions and issues yet to be addressed and resolved, she said. When this is out of the way, the results of the study can be officially published. Doll-Tepper was unable to confirm that this would happen before the end of the year. It all depended on how quickly sports officials signaled their consent, she added. Hardy Graupner, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
You're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink from Bonn, Germany. My name's Matt Herman. listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. Coming up on the next 30 minutes of Newslink, we'll get a new insight on a former Soviet republic in the Caucasus.
Georgia is the most wine-centric place on Earth. Every major happening in life, as well as everyday eating, is totally laced with wine. You know, wine's everywhere.
Well, that sounds like a splendid place to me. More on that story soon. But first, for the first time in more than 50 years, the left has taken a majority in the French upper legislative chamber, the Senate. Although French senators are elected indirectly, and the right is trying to minimize the election's importance, the outcome is a blow to conservative President Nicolas Sarkozy, just 7 months ahead of the French presidential election. Eleanor Beardsley sends us this report.
For the first time since 1958 and the beginning of the Fifth Republic, the usually conservative French Senate has shifted to the left. The news is at the top of every broadcast. One television network called it a political earthquake. The left now holds a thin majority in the French upper house, 177 seats to 171. The socialists attribute their success to discontent in small-town France and the rural heartland, the base of most of the 72,000 delegates who voted Sunday. Sarkozy's party immediately played down the results, calling them of no national political significance, but socialists called it a day that will mark history. Stephen Ekovich is a professor of history at the American University in Paris.
There's no doubt about this, that it's a protest. It's a rejection. It's against Sarkozy, and it's also against the right. There's a general anxiety, frustration.
At the same time, says Ekovich, one shouldn't read too much into the vote. Change in the auguste French upper body is very slow and often reflects underlying incremental social and demographic shifts, which may have no bearing whatsoever on how people vote next May. And don't expect any fights like in the divided American Congress, says Ekovich.
The French Senate, in terms of upper houses and other democracies, is very weak. It doesn't even set its own agenda. The government does that. It can look at legislation that comes from the National Assembly and make suggestions and send it back. It's called the shuttle.
Still, having the Senate allied with the left certainly won't make Sarkozy's job any easier. He's used to having the majority in both houses of parliament, and he'll no longer be able to count on automatic approval of his agenda. Analysts say he can forget about plans to enshrine a balanced budget rule in the French Constitution, but socialists say they don't plan to throw a wrench in the gears of government. Jean-Marie Bell is head of the Senate Socialists. We will make some of our own proposals now, like in finance reform, said Bell, but we have no plans to block the system of governing or be obstructionist in any way. There is another element of symbolic importance in the Senate win. Under the French Constitution, if the president should become incapacitated, it's the head of the Senate, now someone from the left, who becomes interim leader of France. Eleanor Beardsley, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
From pure politics to the politics of food, perhaps. Parisians are pretty much used to buying all sorts of paraphernalia from machines. Train tickets, condoms, mineral water, even chocolate. But now the French are faced with a potential affront to their cherished culinary culture. A baguette machine. Which isn't only a vending machine, but also a little bakery. When you feed it a euro, out comes a freshly baked French loaf. But traditionalists are undecided whether this is good news or a catastrophe. John Lawrenson has been finding out more in the capital of baguettes.
Americans.
La baguette, elle est chaude. Elle sort. Elle est croustillante.
And the baguette's hot. Okay, I'm going to touch this as well. Oh, yeah, it is. Nice and hot. Okay, very good.
Very hot.
Hot and fresh, a crucial thing for French bread, which goes from crunchy on the outside and soft on the inside to rock hard all over in the space of a day. Jean-Louis Hecht, the man behind the baguette machine, has been baking baguettes all his working life at his boulangerie in a small town in eastern France, where one day he had a baking revelation.
I know all my customers. Some of them, when they'd forgotten to come before closing time, used to ring my bell because I lived above the bakery, and I'd come down and have a bit of a chat and sell them a baguette. But when I went back up, my wife used to complain that the dinner was cold. You're never there. Nag, nag, nag. So one day I said, don't worry, I'm going to have a machine fitted.
Frankly, his wife probably would have been happy enough if he just had made a vending machine to sell pre-cooked baguettes. But then customers with funny hours or late-night French stick cravings would have found themselves buying bread that was not only cold, but with baguette rigor mortis setting in. So he had a smart idea to pack his machine with baguettes which are only two-thirds cooked, because only partially cooked dough stays fresh for 3 days. The machine completes the baking as the baguettes get near the front of the queue to be sold. American visitor Megan Stahl, who's come from a different neighbourhood with her friends especially to use this machine, thinks it's brilliant.
It's a great idea.
You think you could use this sort of machine, yeah?
Yeah. If I lived here, I would.
You don't like the idea of going into a traditional boulangerie, bonjour madame, all that kind of stuff?
Well... Yeah. Depends on if I feel good about my French that day. This is easier in the middle of the night.
That's true.
Which is when I usually want a baguette.
And the French nationals turning up at regular intervals to put their euro in the slot were keen too, like Paul Devers, who says he's even prepared to sacrifice some other small pleasures in order to buy his bread here.
C'est super pratique, il n'y a pas la queue à faire. En plus, le pain est d'un bon rapport qualité-prix.
It's super convenient. You don't have to stand in line, and the bread is good for the price. I must admit that I sometimes go to a traditional boulangerie near here because the woman who sells the bread is extremely charming. But the bread isn't as good, so it's a compromise, like so many things in life.
Si. Ça s'appelle?
Un gâteau lorrain. Y avec ça?
C'est tout.
An extract from La Boulangère de Monceau, a film Monsieur de Ware doubtless has in his DVD collection, a tale of seduction and French pastries that was shot a few metro stations away from the baguette machine. Paris has 1,203 boulangeries, doubtless the densest bread distribution network in the world. Traditionalists say it would be a cultural catastrophe if their existence were threatened, but baguette machine man Jean-Louis Hecht says they must adapt or die. It's true that France is not vending machine mad Japan, where there's one vending machine for every 23 inhabitants, selling everything from eggs to Buddhist prayers, but, says Hecht, the French are getting there.
10 or 15 years ago, when you needed 200 francs, you'd say you were going to the bank where you'd withdraw 200 francs over the counter. Nowadays, you say you're going to the ATM. So why shouldn't things evolve the same way for bread, especially as the quality of the product assured by this method is brilliant? It's as good as it could possibly be.
Take a packet there.
But is it really?
Right, you want to taste this bread? Tastes like the real thing. Well, it is the real thing, what am I saying? Nice and warm, fresh baguette.
John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
Information and perspectives from a European point of view. Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herman. The Turkish government is claiming a major diplomatic breakthrough with Washington. The Prime Minister has said the U.S. has let him know that it will allow Turkey to use its deadly Predator drones in Turkey's fight against the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. Turkey has been asking for access to the Predator for years. Impressed by the success that the U.S. has had in using them in its battle against Islamist insurgent groups in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, Turkey sees the decision as part of a deepening relationship with the U.S. military.
Turkey is hailing the U.S. commitment to give it permission to use its Predator drones as a major triumph. Former Turkish diplomat Sinan Ülgen, who's a visiting research fellow at the U.S.-based Carnegie Institute, says President Obama is rewarding Turkey for its support in the region, in particular its decision to participate in NATO's anti-missile system aimed at neutralizing Iran.
The big
big element in this equation was Turkey's acceptance for hosting the early warning radars of the missile defense initiative. And now Ankara's policy with regard to Damascus has been closely concerted with Washington. And now the two sides are really on the same page, and parts of that overall equation, the U.S. administration gave positive signals regarding the transfer of the Predators to Turkey.
The Predators are seen as key in the Turkish Armed Forces' fight against the Kurdish rebels, the PKK. Until recently, it had used Israeli-produced drones, but that ended when Ankara severed all military ties with Jerusalem following Israel's deadly assault on a Turkish ship bound for Gaza. There is added urgency, with the PKK stepping up its fight, killing 6 soldiers and wounding 11 others in a single attack last weekend, according to Metehan Demir. Demir is a former fighter pilot and now a defense journalist.
The biggest problem for Turkey in fighting against terrorism is the infiltration of PKK terrorists from northern Iraq. Turkey has been trying to take necessary measures to stop the infiltration, but always failed. Predators are the key instruments to survey the area from the air. Also, some of their versions are armed.
Drones are part of Ankara's wider strategy against the PKK. The Prime Minister says the drones' arrival next spring will coincide with the deployment of over 5,000 newly trained elite police officers and soldiers. That announcement follows Erdogan having ruled out further talks towards a political solution to the 27-year-old conflict. But some observers say that's precisely the wrong course to take. Political scientist Cengiz Aktar says the expected offensive against the rebels based in Iraq will only make matters worse.
The PKK guerrillas are, of course, in the mountains, but they are also in the country. They are in the cities. It will put more oil on the fire.
Last week's fatal bombing in the capital, Ankara, by a splinter group of the PKK, with the warning of further attacks to come, underlined Akhtar's fear. Last weekend, security forces detained scores of members of the country's main legal pro-Kurdish party under anti-terror laws. Over 3,000 of its members are now in jail. Confrontation, rather than negotiation, looks to be the direction Turkey is heading in. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
Wangari Maathai, Kenya's mother of trees, died in a Nairobi hospital on Sunday, aged 71, after a long struggle with ovarian cancer. She was the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize for her campaign to save Kenyan forests. Dagmar Breitenbach has more on the woman who regarded the destruction of Kenyan forests as a, quote, matter of life and death for the country.
Come, let's plant trees was a favorite tune that Wangari Maathai often sang with fellow environmentalists. It was the motto that shaped her life. In 1977, Maathai founded the Green Belt Movement to prevent the deterioration of environmental and social conditions in rural Kenya. Then she planted 7 trees. But her project to put the brakes on deforestation quickly spread to other countries. The group has meanwhile planted some 40 million trees across the entire continent. Her reforestation work in Kenya won Maathai the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. Mama Miti, as Kenyans call her, became the first African woman, the first Kenyan, and the first environmentalist to receive this honor.
We really need to protect. We need to do whatever it takes to protect the environment. Because if we do not protect our environment, we are going to literally commit our future generations to misery and death.
In Kenya, the movement expanded to embrace wider campaigns for social, economic, and political change, setting Maathai on a collision course with the government of then-President Daniel Arap Moi. The activist paid a high price for her unflagging devotion to African causes. She was repeatedly whipped, tear-gassed, and threatened by police. Maathai was born in the Central Highlands of Kenya. She earned a master's degree in the United States before becoming the first woman in Kenya to receive a doctorate for veterinary medicine and first to be appointed a professor. Maathai, who was also elected to Parliament in 2002 and appointed Assistant Minister for the Environment in 2003, constantly warned.
When you are poor,
when you are underdeveloped, when you are using the resources at their primary level, depending on the land for food, depending on water in the rivers, depending on the rain, the environment is not a luxury. It is an essential part of your life, and you need to protect it.
Edward Wageni, the Greenbelt Movement's deputy executive director, announced that Matai, who had long struggled with cancer, died in a Nairobi hospital late on Sunday. She had been in and out of the clinic since the beginning of the year. As tributes poured in from all over the world on Monday, Wageni said that Kenya has lost a woman who made a great contribution to the country, a woman whose courage of conviction he greatly admired.
Once you believe in something and you believe it's for the good of the nation and the world, doing it without having to look at who is applauding you.
In recent years, Wangari Maathai founded green groups and launched several campaigns against climate change and environmental protection. She perpetually fought for a greener world. Mama Miti's heritage, the many parks and forests that would not exist but for her and her dedication. Dagmar Breitenbach, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Around the world, around the clock, news and perspectives from the heart of Europe on DWTV, Deutsche Welle Radio, and online too at dwworld.de. This is Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. The biggest beverage manufacturers in the world are the likes of Coca-Cola and Pepsi, outfits who some criticize as being out to do little more than make a quick buck with sugary beverages. We could just drink water, of course, but some of us like a sweet beverage now and again, and are looking for an alternative that's concerned with sustainability and climate justice, perhaps even health. Enter the Hamburg-based company Lemonade. The last three letters in that name, by the way, are AID. The fair trade company makes organic soft drinks, teas. Charity is their name. I bet you can figure out how that might be spelled. And obviously, lemonades. It invests a percentage of its profits in social projects in developing countries. Our correspondent in Hamburg, Julian Bona, met up with the two founders of Lemonade and filed this report.
On a Friday night in a trendy bar in Hamburg's famous St. Pauli district, the weekend is just kicking off. As may be expected, many of the punters drink beer. Many of those who opt for soft drinks, however, order little green or red bottles of charity. The drink is relatively new to the market. It's made by the young Hamburg-based company Lemonade Beverages, which has based its business model on the principles of social and environmental fairness. One of Lemonade's two founder directors is 30-year-old Paul Bethke.
Lemonade is a beverage company, basically, but is based on a very different idea. We are supporting farmers in the third world countries through selling their products here in Europe, meaning lemonade and charity. Charity is a tea product. Lemonade is a simple lemonade. And the money we earn here goes back to the people who supply us with the raw materials, such as juice, sugar, and so forth.
Lemonade is one of the first soft drink companies in Germany to apply the fair trade principle. And 2 years after it entered the highly competitive drinks market, it's already profitable. One reason for its success, the company believes, is that its drinks are made only from fresh and natural ingredients. They're based on recipes which Bethke devised himself, together with his co-founder, 30-year-old Jakob Berndt.
We didn't have any experience in producing drinks, but we thought we liked our drinks to be very simple, like homemade. And that's why we started in my kitchen and just started squeezing out limes and brewed a lot of tea and used different kind of juices and mixed it all together, but all with a very simple technique. And then we invited friends to a party and they all tried the drinks and told us put a little bit more sugar in there or a little bit less juice or whatever. And then at the end of the day, we found a recipe which we all thought was great, and then we started filling it into bottles.
At the moment, Lemonade makes beverages in 5 different flavors. They all come in sleek-looking bottles that were designed by the Swedish agency BVD. The stylish and modern product design, in combination with a tailor-made marketing strategy, is the second reason behind Lemonade's quick success, says Jakob Berndt.
We thought that design is a very important factor in our mission, because everything in the fair trade market so far does look really old school and does not appeal very attractive to younger target groups. And we thought we like to convince especially younger people to consume more sustainable. And we support little independent music festivals. We do a lot in the arts and graphic business. We cooperate with small fashion labels. We do parties. We do a lot of things which don't feel too fair trade and too eco.
In reality, however, it's the opposite. Because the fair trade principle doesn't go far enough for Bernd and Bethke, the two have launched a charitable organization into which Lemonade channels a set percentage of its profits. That money, €40,000 in 2010, funds additional educational or medical projects in the supplier communities. The company's high social priorities are owed to the fact that both Bernd and Bethke found themselves disillusioned with their former jobs. Bernd worked in an advertising agency and wanted to do something more purposeful. Bethke was a development worker in Sri Lanka for an organization funded by the German government. But he says he was disappointed with the way in which aid money was being spent.
I realize that it doesn't work because it doesn't have any efficiency goal. It doesn't have a business model at the basis. So it's just a clan of people who hang around and spend other people's money and don't have any relation to it. And using this way, the people who use the money, like us in this case, have a completely different relation to the money they have to spend because we worked for it a whole year. I want to know what happened to the €40,000 we spent last year on social projects. I'm going to go there to those countries and see what happened. I want to see effects.
The success of Lemonade so far proves Bernd and Bethke right. They're expecting to double the annual number of bottles sold to 1.5 million this year. Right now, their drinks are available almost exclusively in restaurants and bars like the one in St. Pauli. Although there has been interest from large supermarket chains, Bernd and Bethke are taking it slow. They aren't interested, they say, in flogging their product just for the sake of making a quick penny. Julian Bohne, Deutsche Welle Radio, Hamburg.
Moving to a more potent potable now. Back in 2006, Russia imposed an import ban on wines from Georgia. The official reason? Health standards and concerns about counterfeiting. But many industry analysts said the ban was actually motivated by an ugly spying dispute between Moscow and Tbilisi. Either way, the embargo wiped out roughly 80% of Georgian winemakers' export market. 5 years later, Russia has hinted that it might be prepared to lift that ban as it moves closer to becoming a member of the World Trade Organization. That's good news for many Georgian winemakers, but it's also a worry for those who spent the last 5 years developing new markets elsewhere. Our correspondent Marika Aden has more from the Georgian wine region of Kakhetia.
So we have to wait a few minutes because the gas is coming off. Right now we're fermenting inside, and when you're fermenting, if you breathe in too much of the gas, then we'll get lightheaded.
The American John Verdeman has come to check on his grapes, which were harvested just a couple of weeks ago. Behind a wooden door in a wine cellar at his vineyard, dozens of big clay jars are buried in the ground, covered by wooden lids. Inside, grapes are fermenting. At this early stage, the wine has an alcohol level of only 1%. This is a traditional Georgian way of winemaking here in Kakhetia, one of Georgia's main wine regions in the country's northeast. Wine has been made here for over 8,000 years. The clay jars in an oval shape, called quaveries, are one of the secrets of Georgian wine, says Verdeman.
Basically, the wine naturally filters itself through gravity. So everything heavy in the wine, all the impurities, goes to the bottom. That's why the shape of the quaver is so important. And then we will siphon off the top the juice into a clean quaver to a neighboring quaver. And you keep moving it from quaver to quaver. And then the clean juice that's at the top, you keep moving.
35-year-old Würdemann, who wears his long blonde red hair in a ponytail, is actually a professional artist. He grew up in New Mexico and first arrived in Georgia in the late 90s. It was the country's traditional music and the landscape of the South Caucasus which attracted him, and he quickly learned that with over 500 different grape varieties, Georgia is the cradle of wine.
Georgia is the most wine-centric place on earth. Every major happening in life, as well as everyday eating, is totally laced with wine. You know, wine's everywhere.
These days, Werdemann speaks fluent Georgian, lives with his Georgian wife, and has dual citizenship. His foray into the wine business began in 2006 when a local winemaker drove by on his tractor as Werdemann painted a vineyard. The man came with a business proposition, and shortly afterwards, together with another American and a Swedish investor, they founded the wine company Pheasant Tears, named after a legend that a certain wine can make pheasants cry. To Werdemann, local traditions, organic production, and the variety of grapes are the key to the success of Georgian wines worldwide.
There's something special about this place. The wind here, the amount of precipitation, the amount of sunlight, the soil composition, the rocks that are here. And if you're going to overly process your wine, if you're going to use foreign yeast that aren't native to here, it's stripping the face of the wine away.
A 20-minute drive away from the vineyard is the little town of Signagi. That's where Werdemann is heading now. Signagi has cobbled streets and is set against spectacular mountain scenery. The town was recently overhauled with government money to attract more international tourists to the wine region. It's here that Werdemann and his partners aim to sell their bottles to visitors for 15 to 35 euros each. In Signagi, they are running a wine bar that has a little restaurant. Gela Patalishvili, the local winemaker who first proposed the business idea to Werdemann, is already waiting there. Patalishvili approached Werdemann in 2006, just after Russia banned Georgian wine imports after a spying scandal. The dispute saw Russia, which imported more than 80% of the wine produced in Georgia in 2005, suddenly disappear as a customer, leaving a surplus of 40 million bottles on the market. That was a real shock, remembers Patalishvili.
It was a time when Georgian wine was made with very little artistry or care. It was very lucrative, but we weren't very proud about the quality of the wine.
Gela Patalishvili is, however, very proud of the wine he produces now with Werdemann, even if it is on a small scale. The 40,000 bottles they make annually are exported to 9 countries, mainly to Hong Kong, the UK, Sweden and the USA. The company hopes to expand production to 80,000 bottles a year soon. Russia recently indicated it is ready to discuss lifting its ban for Georgian wine. Experts believe this is connected to Moscow's bid to become a member of the World Trade Organization, an application that Georgia, which is already a member, could veto. While many Georgian winemakers would welcome the end of Russian restrictions, John Werdemann believes it was good that the industry was forced in previous years to look beyond Russia for potential buyers and to focus on quality instead of quantity.
So then we have to ask ourselves the question, well, what happens now if the market's opened? Frankly, a lot of us are afraid. We feel like although a transformation started, that it needs a little bit more time, and that it might be actually best for the wine industry, in terms of the quality of the wines, to keep it closed for another year or two.
It seems that Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili also feels torn. On the one hand, his crisis-ridden country could certainly use the Russian wine market to get more cash into the economy. On the other, he's reluctant to see the wine industry rely so heavily on a single market, something he stressed while touring the country's wine region at the beginning of September. Saakashvili knows, and all Georgians know, that Russia's appetite for Georgian wine is big, but it could very well be spoiled again quite soon, depending on political flavors. Mareike Aden, Deutsche Welle Radio, Kakhetia.
That's all for this edition of Newslink. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. I'm Matt Herman. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.